times have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about the topic of debt. A lot of confusion about the role of debt, and I'd like to clarify that a little bit in relationship both to what's going on here today. We see it in the stock markets and other financial markets and now in the real economy. What's the relationship of debt to the real economy, to financial markets and financial price deflation, and in general to the whole topic of recession? As you know, I've been saying we're on our way to a recession here by late 2019. Increasingly, what we've got is market economists, business economists, heads of banks, research, and so forth. They're beginning to say, oops, you know, here comes the recession. 2020, maybe 2019 now, they're beginning to say. At the same time, mainstream economists, being the most conservative and the worst forecasters, are beginning to still adhere to their conservative view that, no, the economy is going to recover nicely. All right. Also, we see more people beginning to agree with the view I've had for at least a year that the Fed will not raise interest rates any further. And secondly, there will be a trade war, quote, resolution between China and the U.S. relatively soon. Okay, so let's jump into this topic of debt and try to understand the relationship of debt, because both in the U.S. and globally, we've had a massive run-up of additional debt since the 2008-09 crash, which was caused largely by debt. Debt, of course, is the other side of the coin of credit. When a lender extends credit and it's accepted, the borrower incurs a debt. So credit and debt are really the same thing. All right, what's the current global scenario? Well, pretty clear, everybody's agreeing that the global economy is slowing down. Well, it's even more serious than that, I believe. We have a global manufacturing recession already begun. Manufacturing is estimated by this indicator called the PMI, right? Purchasing Managers Index. And when that index falls less than the number 50, less than half, that means that it's contracting. It's going backwards. It's not growing anymore. It's not even growing slowly. It's contracting. Okay, and what does that scenario look like globally for the manufacturing PMI? Well, in China, it's now negative. It dipped below the 50, so it's contracting. And of course, China is the big engine for durable good exports to the world. And if it's manufacturing, its production of things that would be exported is going down. That's a reflection that global trade is contracting or slowing. At least global trade is slowing. Manufacturing is contracting. And that's kind of important for the economy globally, because a lot of countries depend on China buying their raw materials, their commodities, in order to make the goods, manufacture the goods in China, in order to export to the world. and these commodities might be raw materials, agricultural goods, industrial metals, and other materials. You know, in Latin America, Asia, Africa, very dependent, and Europe, very dependent on its ability to export. And Europe in particular, Germany especially, is dependent on growth for its exports. And if European exports are weakening, then the economy significantly weakens, much more dependent on exports than the U.S. is. And we see in Germany and France and elsewhere now a slowing of exports. And in turn, therefore, a slowing or declining of their manufacturing PMI. Germany, other places in Europe, and now just in the last day, France as well. But the manufacturing slowdown, recession contraction now beginning, has also hit the U.S. We see in regions, according to Federal Reserve Beige Book report on the economy, we see critical regions in the U.S. manufacturing also below 50 or close to 50. You know, used to be in the 55, 56 number range, growing nicely. Now it's well below that, approaching 50. I'm not sure if it turned negative, but it's slowing rapidly. It certainly will turn negative here in the first quarter 2019. Particularly key regions, you know, like the Philadelphia Fed region, New York Fed, Texas, important recession indicators, at least manufacturing recession. Japan's in recession as well. So all the major economies, global manufacturing slowdown and recession has already begun. We see in housing section, construction, globally, the same scenario growing, spreading in different areas. China in particular, major slowdown in the housing sector and housing prices, provoking protests, in fact, in China over decline of housing prices. Australia, big problem over there with housing prices. The EU and UK now, prices, latest prices, they had a big boom there in recent years, and now prices aren't growing at all. They're flat. Construction is flat. And in the U.S., all the indicators, new housing starts, housing permits, you know, other indicators like sale of new home, sale of existing homes, they're all going south. You can't have a recession and housing including commercial property, construction, in other words, you can't have those two key sectors, which don't make up a majority of the economy. Majority of the economy is services in the U.S. particularly. But you can't have those two leading sectors turned down and not have a recession. It spills over eventually. And we're beginning to see something of a spillover. Contagion is beginning to hit the tech sector. We see Apple, Facebook, right? Semiconductor companies, which are always a leading edge, the semiconductor companies and the semiconductor equipment manufacturers kind of lead the tech downturn. And we see that beginning as well. And then it spreads finally, the final phase, over to the services sector. Recessions never originate in services. That's always the last to spill over. Okay. Autos, by the way, manufacturing recession, autos are falling off a cliff now everywhere globally. All right, so what does debt have to do with this current global / U.S. scenario? What did that have to do with the 2008-09 crash and recession? What did it have to do with the 2000-2001 dot-com bust and recession? How about the 1997-98 Asian currency crisis? What does that have to do with that? Or the 1990-92 recessions that hit the U.S., Japan, and Northern Europe? And the next one coming, should it come in 2019 or 2020? What does debt have to do with this? Well, you know, most of the writings on debt are pretty naive. Somehow they just point to the escalation of total debt, which, of course, is an obvious fact going on. Reports by the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, in other words, have clearly showed that we have a massive debt run-up since 2009. If debt was a major factor in the 2008-09 crash, you would have thought that somehow the debt would have been expunged, or as they say, deleveraging. When you say leveraging, what you mean is a debt-driven growth and inflation, leveraging. Households can become leveraged, in other words, overloaded with debt. Businesses can become leveraged, and governments become leveraged. And you would think in good times there would be deleveraging, in other words, paying off the debt, getting rid of it. Well, there was a little bit of deleveraging in households in the U.S. here after 2009, but that has reversed once again. Of course, the U.S. government, the federal government, has not deleveraged, just the opposite, has become even more leveraged, more in debt. In 2008, the total national debt was about $10 trillion, which represented a doubling of the national debt from the time George W. Bush came into office in 2000. So he doubled it to about $10 trillion. And we have more than a doubling, once again, since the last, in the last decade. So $10 trillion when Obama comes into office, and now it's $21 trillion. And it's projected to go well over $30 trillion, given the Trump tax cuts and the escalation of war and defense spending going on. So we are doubling the debt every 10 years. And that can't go on forever because the interest on that debt is rising. The interest this year in the U.S. budget on the debt, I think, was $318 billion. $318 billion we're paying to bondholders, treasury bond and bill holders, about 43% of whom are foreign sources. That's a lot of money, $318 billion. Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, that's going to $900 billion to $1 trillion over the next decade. $1 trillion a year, every year, from the U.S. budget to just pay interest on the debt. Well, if the government is spending money there to pay that interest to the bondholders, well, it's not spending it somewhere else. It's not spending it to stimulate the real economy. It's not spending it on defense. It's not spending it on other sources of government, spending, expenditures, transfer payments, whatever. It's a scenario that's totally unsustainable. Well, what that means is that the key thing about understanding debt is paying the principal and interest on that debt. That's the key thing. It's not just the volume or the magnitude of debt itself. It's, can you afford to pay it? If your economy is growing robustly, then you are generating tax revenues, if it's the government in this case, right? Or businesses are generating profits, or households are generating wage income in order to pay the principal and interest on the rising debt. So debt itself, the magnitude, is not the problem if you can pay for it. And GDP, or economic real growth, is an indicator of the ability to pay for it. If GDP is not growing, right, then incomes are not growing, and tax revenues are not growing, and private profit revenues are not growing, and wage incomes are not growing. And if the debt keeps growing, but the means to pay for it is not growing, then you got a big problem. And, well, it's pretty clear that the deficit and the debt have been growing faster than the ability to pay for it, than the growth of incomes. That's a key problem here, right? Now, debt, credit, and debt can accelerate economic growth. So, you know, not all debt is bad. Depends, debt for what, right? Are you borrowing in order to expand your business and hire people and give wage increases and so forth? Is that what debt is being used, credit debt is being used for? Well, if so, then debt is good. But if you're borrowing to use the money not to really invest in expanding the real economy, then you're accumulating debt while you're not accumulating the means to pay for it. And that's what's been happening increasingly, not just since 2008, but since the 1980s. You see, neoliberal policy is based upon the expansion of debt. It's an essential element of neoliberalism. Okay, so what does it look like here in terms of the ability to invest and expand the economy? You know, debt can be an accelerator of real investment and therefore economic growth, right? Well, ordinarily, in classical economics at least, investment in expanding production is, quote, financed, paid for, in other words, through profits. But that's not the way capitalism really works anymore. It's not profits that drive investment. In fact, studies show that profits, retained earnings profits, are responsible for only maybe one-fifth of all the investment going on. Well, most of the expansion of production is done by equity investment, in other words, issuing stock, which is a form of debt, by the way. When a company issues stock and purchasers buy that stock, they buy an ownership claim of that stock in that company. It's a kind of a debt. But the real way of financing by businesses is by issuing corporate bonds and other forms of corporate debt, like commercial paper and so forth. That's what's fueled most of it. In other words, an indication of the dependency on debt, even for real growth. Right? Corporate bonds come in many shades and forms, short-term bonds, 2 and 5 years, 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds, right? These bonds might be what's called investment-grade bonds, about $4 trillion in the U.S., investment-grade bonds, or what's called junk bonds, meaning corporations issuing those bonds, junk bonds, have to pay a higher interest rate to the buyers of those bonds, because their companies aren't as solid and stable. They're shakier. You know, maybe they shouldn't even be in business. They're not making money. So we have junk bonds and high-grade bonds. But in between, even in the high-grade bonds, they have, like, ratings. And the lowest rating is triple B ratings. So junk bonds have been growing rapidly since 2009. The junk bond market, it's several trillion dollars now in the U.S., I'm talking. But investment grade, $4 trillion bonds, most of that is made up of junk investment grade, triple B bonds. In other words, companies, if you look at the triple B and the junk bond numbers, companies that should probably have gone out of business after 2009 because they weren't making money have kept themselves alive by borrowing at high interest rates. And incurring what's called triple B or junk bond leveraging. Usually these bonds are short term, relatively short term, and have to be rolled over. There's trillions of dollars of junk and triple B that need to be rolled over in the coming year and years, short term. If there's a recession, they won't be able to roll them over. Oh, if you can't roll over your bonds, in other words, get new bonds to pay off the old bonds, even at a higher interest rate, well, then you're going to go out of business. You're going to not be able to pay your old bonds because you can't roll them over, right? You're not able to pay the principal and or interest on your old bonds. And when you can't do that, well, then you default. Default means you're simply not paying principal and interest, or interest. And when you default, whoever owns the bonds and the banks, investors, can force the company into bankruptcy. And then, of course, all the real jobs in that company disappear. And, of course, that the suppliers of that company and so forth all have stress and problems. So bonds, corporate bonds, are a important form of corporate debt. Bank loans, of course, are another form of debt. And there's several kinds of bank loans, commercial and industrial loans, leverage loans, which are borrowing in order to buy other companies, heavily relied upon by private equity firms, and other forms of loans, many forms of loans. So loans and bonds, corporate, are the two major forms of corporate debt. Well, we know corporate debt, over $50 trillion in corporate debt out there. Stock market valuations over $25 trillion. Profits, maybe 5 to 7 trillion U.S. I'm going to talk about in all this. And it's all, except for profits, it's all forms of debt. In other words, debt dwarfs. Profits are dwarfed by all this massive debt that the system runs on now. But that's not the only form of debt. Corporations, both financial and non-financial. Again, bond debt, loan debt, stock debt, whatever. Households have debt as well. And that's been accelerating since 2009. Well, the most important areas of debt, like mortgage loans, right? That's an important debt, about $10 trillion outstanding. Mortgage loans in the U.S., which is about what it was in 2007-8. In other words, it deleveraged some and then it ran back up here. Although it's not in the form of subprimes anymore. They've expunged that. But there's other kinds of debt, mortgage loan debt, that still exists and has grown. Auto loans, $1.2 trillion. Student loans, $1.5 trillion going to $2 trillion. Credit cards, over $1 trillion. So payday loans, right? Installment personal loans. All of these, you add them together, we're probably about $15 trillion, $14, $15 trillion in debt. So the corporate sector, you know, three, four times the debt levels of the household sector. But without this debt, you would not have the real economic growth. Some of this has gone into real economic growth that you have had here since 2009. Now, the U.S. government is also in debt, not just households, not just businesses, but the U.S. government debt has escalated as well. And we've talked about that. In other words, the $21 trillion national debt. But that's not the whole picture of the national debt. You got the agencies of the government, like Federal Reserve. Its balance sheet is over $4 trillion in debt. Other special agencies, like housing agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, et cetera, you add up all those special agencies, probably $1 trillion in debt. And they never talk much about state and local government debt. It's hard to estimate it, but you know, that's probably another $10, $15 trillion. I don't know those numbers exactly, but, you know, the federal government, you know, total government in the U.S., somewhere between $30, $40 trillion in debt. And the higher the debt, the greater the principal, in other words, the greater the payments must be, regardless of the interest rate. And but then if the interest rate on that rising magnitude of debt also rises, well, then the debt payments are even higher. So principal and rates drive the total amount of payments that must be made. Now, how are you going to pay for your debt? You have to generate income somewhere, right? Businesses have to generate revenue. Households have to have wage income, and governments have to generate taxes. That's their form of revenue and income to pay for this rising debt load. And if rates are interest rates are rising, which they have been 2 years, then even more so. How do you generate the income to pay the rising principal and interest on the debt due to the rising volume, magnitude of debt, and now rising interest rates? How do you generate that income is the question. Well, if we look at households, they haven't been generating income. Wages have been stagnant, especially for the bottom 90%, or in real terms, going south, right? Just the top 10%, really, that we've seen any kind of real wage increases. So that's a problem on the household side, financing that debt. On the business side, we have multinational corporations that have done okay in terms of generating profits and income, cash flow, to finance the principal and interest. But a lot of companies that aren't multinational haven't been able to generate, that have been dependent on consumers and households, haven't been able to generate that much income in order to pay their rising principal and interest, particularly the junk bond and triple B companies. Right. So what does that portend for the ability to pay this ever-rising principal and interest charges? And, of course, the government hasn't been raising its tax revenues. Just the opposite. It's been cutting taxes massively, especially since 2008-09. It was cutting them significantly before that, under George Bush, $3.8 trillion in tax cuts, mostly to investors and businesses, particularly investors and the wealthy 1%. Who are the investors? But since then, 2008-09, it's escalated. The tax cuts have escalated And, you know, we got maybe another $5-6 trillion in tax cuts under Obama, again, to the same folks. And now we have Trump's $4-5 trillion on top of that. So the government, federal government, has been cutting taxes, you know, to the tune of $15 trillion in the first couple of decades here of the 21st century. Well, that means reduced tax revenue. Well, how do they pay the principal and interest on the debt, the $318 billion this year? Well, if you don't have the income, you can borrow more to pay the interest on your old debt. In other words, you roll it over. And that's what the federal government has been doing. And not only the federal government, the state and local government has been a tax cut race to the bottom, particularly in the Republican red states. So the state and local governments are in trouble because of tax cutting as well. And turning more and more to adding more debt to pay the old debt. You see, that's what junk bond companies do. They roll over the old debt by borrowing new to pay the old. And even though they may be paying a little bit more, they barely continue to survive in normal good times. When recessions and bad times come, well, then they collapse. Well, the U.S. government, federal government and state governments are able to borrow money by issuing bonds, government bonds or municipal bonds in the case of state and local governments. Well, every year, the government has to sell more and more bonds in order to raise the equivalent of the deficit to keep the spending going. So at the federal level, it's debt driven. It's amazing that with slow growth, which has been the case until this past year, that the U.S. government, despite the slow growth, is cutting taxes by trillions and raising defense spending by hundreds of billions. You know, now over $700 billion, just the, you know, the Pentagon cost here, going up another $100 billion coming year, which doesn't cover all the costs because there's past costs of the war and defense in other agencies of the U.S. economy and government. Homeland Security is not in that $720 billion, I think it is now, Pentagon bill. Costs for wars are off budget. Afghanistan has been off budget, or what they call OCO spending. Costs for veterans, particularly medical care and veterans, other veterans' benefits. Costs for paying for the fuel for the military, that's an energy budget. Costs for nuclear weapons, that's an atomic energy budget. And so on. And then black budget doesn't show up in the printed numbers for the deficit, which is at least $75 billion a year, maybe more. So it's over $1 trillion. We've given $15 trillion in tax cuts since George W. Bush and $1 trillion every year in war spending, and that creates a massive deficit that has to be financed by borrowing, by debt, by selling treasury bonds and bills. And that just keeps piling up. Going to be over $30 trillion here in the next decade, well over $30 trillion. So households at $14, $15 trillion, corporations maybe $50 trillion, government maybe $30 trillion. That's the massive debt run-up in the U.S. Okay, tens of trillions of dollars additional here just since the 2009 crash. Now, debt, as I said, the borrowing might go into fueling expanding investment and production of real goods and services. Households may take on debt to buy durable goods and non-durable goods and even services, student services, in other words, education. Businesses will take on debt to expand their structures, their equipment, even their inventory. Government spending may increase purchasing of war goods and so forth. And production may be increased for exports by business, etc. Okay, so debt can finance economic growth, right? But debt also fuels financial asset purchases. Not only fuels real investment, real consumption, it fuels financial assets. In other words, corporations, businesses, investors, even households will borrow money and incur greater debt in order to reinvest that money into financial markets. Good example is borrowing money, margin loans, and so forth to invest in equities and stocks. Borrowing money for corporations to invest in bonds that they then use the proceeds of which to pay their shareholders by buying back stocks or paying out dividends. Yes, a good example I've said before is Apple, sitting on $250 billion in cash, issuing bonds in recent years to raise money, incurring debt, raising money, that it then uses to pay its shareholders and to buy back its own stock, to keep its stock price up. And then there's, of course, purchasing of currencies, foreign exchange, and doing it as it rises or falls with these various currencies, and then flipping it for a capital gains, pure speculation, largely in dollars, yen, euros, and British pounds. So foreign exchange financial asset markets globally are a source of using of debt-raised funds to purchase financial assets called currencies. Bonds are financial assets. Stocks are financial assets, right? Borrowing what's called leverage loans by businesses in order to acquire other businesses, mergers and acquisitions, which is at $4 trillion, back where it was in 2007. Merger and acquisition activity also peaked out like housing, so right back where it was. Leverage loans, it's called, another area of instability. Because companies that investors, professional investors, private equity firms are at the center of this, shadow banks called private equity firms. And mergers and acquisitions, you know, a major area of financial speculation. Derivatives, all kinds of derivatives out there worth tens of trillions of dollars. We don't know how big that is because they don't really have to report it except for simple derivatives like interest rate swaps and so forth. But most of these derivatives, we don't know how much debt, how much borrowing has been done to buy derivatives by investors and corporations and businesses. Except that it's very, very common, you see, particularly a derivative called credit default swaps, which is kind of an insurance contract. Corporations buy this all the time, huge amounts. And of course, they borrow in order to do that. So financial asset spending financed by debt, by borrowing, is a major problem in 21st century capitalism. Major problem. And it does not generate real growth. It generates paper profits for the investors, but not real growth. Well, it's the real growth that pays for the debt and the interest and the principal. But if most of the borrowing, and this is the case, most of the borrowing now goes into fueling financial asset markets, not real investment. Or if you live in the UK, US, you know, some of that borrowing might go into real investment offshore, not onshore. Doesn't therefore do anything for the US economy and the rest of us. It may fatten a corporation if they can make profits off of that debt-driven investment elsewhere in emerging markets, but not for us. So this is an important characteristic of the global economy today, 21st century capitalism, that we have accelerating credit debt-driven investment in financial assets. Far greater total amount of debt raised to buy financial assets than to invest in real assets, meaning structures, buildings, equipment, inventories, and so forth. That's real investment. Okay. All right, so we have, in absolute levels, not only debt rising, you know, accelerating, but the proportion of that debt, that rising debt going into fueling financial prices going on, financial assets. Of course, when you buy financial assets, that increases the demand for those assets and increases the price of those assets. So you get financial asset price inflation, are sometimes called bubbles, when it gets out of whack. And that's been going on. We have bubbles that have been growing. And now, by the way, we'll talk about it more shortly, the bubbles are deflating. And what does that mean? Well, it means that you have a relationship, causal relationship between debt, right, and financial asset investment and financial asset prices inflation, and then financial asset price deflation. The debt is the ultimate cause of the deflation in financial asset prices. Of course, the next set of questions is, well, what does financial asset price deflation have to do with the real economy and recessions? Which means now we're at, what is the relationship between debt and recessions? Well, the conduit is through financial asset markets. Okay. The problem with debt, okay, principal and interest not only has to be paid, but it has to be paid through cash flow or income flows that are earned. Corporations earn money either by selling more or raising their prices for their goods and services. Households pay for their debt by wage income, and government by taxation. But of course, if the taxation is insufficient as we described, or the wages are not growing as we described, then the only solution to pay for the principal and interest is to undertake even more debt to pay off the old debt. And the same thing happens with companies. You know, if their sales, if they're in a market or in a business or something, their sales are weakening, or competition, global, whatever, their sales are weakening, and they're, if sales are weakening, you can't raise your prices. You probably end up lowering your prices. Then you're not generating the income to pay the principal and interest on your debt, either because of falling sales, declining prices, or both. Wages are just the price of labor. Taxes are just the price of government services. So we're talking about prices here. When prices begin to fall, income cash flow is unavailable to pay the principal and interest on the debt. And in this country, of course, we've seen wages stagnating and taxes declining. And prices have not risen that much because of the relatively weak economy. And now sales volumes are beginning to decline as well. Good example is the auto industry, where sales volumes have clearly turned down. And, of course, the housing sector, where sales volumes are turning down, and therefore prices soon follow. The problem with debt is it doesn't matter if your income from prices, wages, or taxes is no longer sufficient to pay the principal and interest on the debt. The debt remains, no matter, you know, what your ability to pay for it happens to be. And in fact, when your prices, your ability to pay for it declines, as economists will say, the real debt actually rises. So you might be paying off your debt, a company, with declining sales revenues, trying desperately to pay it off, but because you have deflating prices, your real debt is actually rising, getting larger. Your ability to pay for it is declining, even though you're paying it off. So, to conclude partially here, debt may lead to real investment and real growth, but it may accelerate financial instability, cause booms and busts if the debt is going to finance financial asset markets. And that eventually leads to financial asset deflation. You can see this in the stock market. You know, $1 trillion a year in the U.S. alone since 2010 has gone into stock buybacks and dividend payouts. And now it's at a record this year, $1.3 trillion, maybe more, in buybacks and payouts. Okay. A lot of that money has, most of it has gone into financial asset markets, not into real expansion of the real economy. Right. And it's driven up the price of these financial assets. The stock market, of course, surged to record levels. And in the last year, in particular, it surged to an artificial top as Trump tax cut fattened corporate profits by 22% to 27%, and much of that went into financial assets and boosted the stock market, you know, an extra 10-15%. And now we see that unwinding here since October. Totally artificial, you know, the Trump tax cuts, $1 trillion, maybe this year, $500 billion to $1 trillion, somewhere in that area. Trump tax cuts, at least $500 billion, much of it went into the stock boom, the top here in 2018. And that has caused an artificial run-up, which is running down now. Okay, so it can cause, debt can cause financial instability and financial busts, financial market busts. We see it in the stock market. We see it in the bond market, particularly high-yield bonds, BBB bonds. We see it in foreign exchange currencies outside the U.S., where these currencies have been collapsing. In some areas by 50%, like Argentina, its currency collapsed 50%, right? Turkey, maybe 30%, and a whole host of other countries, 10 to 20% collapse in the value of their currencies. Well, when their currencies collapse, investors in those countries and outside those countries who are holding that currency want to get rid of it. Who wants to hold an asset that is falling in value? They try to get rid of it, sell it for the currency that's rising, which has been the dollar. And that only causes a greater contraction of the real economy, because if you take the money out, there's less money to invest, to expand the real economy. And of course, even their financial markets, they began to contract as well. And that's what we see happening in many places in emerging markets. Right? We see it happening in the stock market, in the bond markets, and in the foreign exchange markets. And now we see the deflation going on in housing and property prices as well. So we have this slow-rolling financial asset market bust that's moving from sector to sector, beginning to emerge. It's not a full-blown crash yet, but the indications are contagion across financial asset markets. Right? Well, when you have financial asset prices and values collapsing, right, it spills over to the real economy. How is that? Well, banks and other corporations that are holding these financial assets that are then collapsing in value, right, pull back their horns on real investment. And when that happens, of course, you get slowing wage increases and layoffs. And you get worst case scenarios when you have corporate defaults, when they can't pay the principal and interest, period, and the whole process accelerates. Right? So financial asset instability, i.e. deflation, falling prices, eventually spills over to the real economy. Now, sometimes it can spill over very fast and very deep. Well, we saw that in 2008-09, right? When the banks started crashing and lending froze up everywhere, corporations responded in October, November, December of 2008 by simply almost shutting down. And when that happens, we had 1 million people a month losing their jobs for about 6 months almost, right? So that's a big spillover to the real economy. So the picture is debt leads to financial bubbles, leads to financial busts, leads to freezing of credit in the real economy, leads to mass layoffs, which leads to a collapse of consumption, because when people don't have incomes, they don't buy things. And when consumption collapses, of course, it sends a signal to business, oh, you better batten down the hatches even further and lay off even more. And then you're in a vicious downturn. The whole instability has spilled over into the real economy. That's what happened in 2008-09. Okay. Corporations in this situation will also lower their prices, trying desperately to sell more, lower wages, cut benefits, and lay off workers, which is a total wage cut for those folks, cut their marketing, and therefore the sales decline, squeeze their suppliers, right, who then lower their prices of supplies, intermediate goods, and so forth. So you get deflation spilling over from financial asset prices to real prices, those prices for goods and services. Businesses lower their prices in order to try to sell more, to generate more income in order to pay their principal and interest. Or wages, which are just the price of labor, and benefits, which are wages. And then, of course, other forms of prices. So the price system is the mechanism by which the contagion is spread among financial assets, among and between financial assets, and then eventually spills over and drives down real prices for goods and services and wages. Right? These price systems start interacting and exacerbating each other, driving both the real economy down, which then exacerbates the financial side, and the financial side collapse then exacerbates the real side, and you got this vicious downward cycle going on. And that's how you get the recession. Now, the question is, how do you stop financial asset price deflation? Well, the Federal Reserve can buy up the collapsed financial assets from private investors, stocks and bonds. Of course, the Bank of Japan buys up stocks as well as corporate bonds, as well as government bonds. In the U.S., it was just the Fed buying up government bonds and some private bonds, mortgage bonds. Right? Congress can also step in and subsidize corporate losses, i.e. more tax cuts, i.e. more government buying of defense goods and so forth. The government can force consolidation of failing corporations and banks. We saw that in 2008 going on. Or you can allow the defaults and bankruptcies to run their course. We saw that with Bear Stearns' collapse. The idea that you resolve financial asset price deflation by allowing the defaults and bankruptcies is called liquidationism. And that was the strategy under Herbert Hoover in the early 30s. Right? The idea of the Fed buying up these assets and Congress supplementing it, that's neoliberalism since 1987, the strategy for stopping financial deflation, price deflation. Liquidationism was the early 30s. New Dealism under FDR was a third way of doing this. In other words, you supplement wages, prices on the real economy side, try to keep prices up on the real economy, that would generate consumption, that would then stimulate consumption and purchases so that business revenues would recover and they would rehire people, which would continue the process of an upward cycle. You could have government investment corporations that we had in the 30s, or public works spending, and tax hikes, which we had in the 30s. Significantly, all these are another way of stopping financial asset price deflation. You stop it by stopping the contagion of prices in the real side of the economy first, and that slows down the deflation on the financial side. Well, neoliberalism does it the other way. It says, well, you know, let's stop the financial side deflation by buying up all the assets, the Fed, and hope that by doing that, banks and financial institutions will then start lending once again, and that will stimulate the real economy. So it's ass backwards, you see. You bail out the investors in the financial sector and hope that that does its work to stimulate the rest, which is just the opposite of New Deal and FDR, where you pump the economy from the consumer side, from the real side first, and that will generate the stock market recoveries. That's what happened in the 1930s. 35, 36 was one of the biggest stock booms we've ever had. Okay, well, they don't want to do it that way anymore, because that means bailing out mainstream first before you bail out Wall Street. Now it's all bail out Wall Street and hope that they throw some crumbs at Main Street. And all they've thrown is crumbs. Well, what's the total status of debt and deflation? What's the total debt out there today? About $260 trillion global debt, right? 320% of global GDP. Global GDP is about $80 trillion. So it's more than three times. The debt load's three times GDP, and the debt's growing faster than GDP, right? Household debt, right? About 60%. Of global GDP, or in other words, household debt, globally about $50 trillion, government debt about $60 trillion, financial, corporate, and non-financial corporate debt about $90 trillion. Okay, so massive debt. All right, we'll talk about this some more next week when we talk about what's happening to the financial asset bubbles worldwide.